Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Decade after decade, when times are bad and even when they're better, African Americans struggle with unemployment rates roughly double the overall numbers. Ohio is a good example of that long-term trend. In 2009, at the height of fallout from the Great Recession, Black Ohioans saw a 17.3% rate of unemployment compared to the overall 10.3%. 5 years later, the unemployment rate for Blacks remained at roughly twice the overall rate in the Buckeye State, that is 9.9% versus 5.2% overall. This has been the case since the Civil Rights Movement of the 1960s, since President Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act into law in 1964. Today, we're talking about why that is and how to change the odds. Joining us now by phone is Connie Raza. She's the nonprofit advocacy group Center for Popular Democracy. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
And with us in the studio is Matt Martin. He's a senior researcher at the Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity at Ohio State University. Welcome back, Matt.
It's great to be here.
Connie, you wrote the executive summary for a new report entitled Wall Street, Main Street, and Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard, Why African Americans Must Not Be Left Out of the Federal Reserve's Full Employment Mandate. The report examines the current state of the American economy and labor market, but are there historical factors that would account for the almost constant gap between overall and African American unemployment rates in the U.S.?
Certainly. I mean, I think that you can't dismiss the impact of discrimination as a whole, discrimination in hiring and also at work, and also the over-policing of Black communities. So in at a time when 1 in 3 Black men and 1 in 18 Black women will be imprisoned at some point in their lives, and at a time when criminal records are a major barrier to employment, you can't dismiss the impact of that over-policing on Black communities. But you know, even as we look at that historic impact of discrimination, the fact remains that there is room for us to do better, that the recovery that Americans are slowly seeing as a whole isn't reaching African-American communities yet. And as part the report that you noted is part of a campaign called the Set Up Campaign, which is looking at the role that the Federal Reserve can play in ensuring that we see a robust recovery, a robust economic recovery, before we start slowing down the economy.
But, you know, Matt Martin, even in times of good, you know, in great economic times, there's always this, it's an omnipresent gap in unemployment rates between the general and Black Americans, and it gets even more pronounced once you break out whites.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, one of the things that we see is that there are multiple systems and factors at play. Connie mentioned one of them being mass incarceration, over-policing of these communities. But when we look at things like the school-to-prison pipeline, you know, the gaps in discipline in schools, when we look at social networks, we look at transit equity, access to jobs, how do you actually get to jobs, and then our healthcare system. And so there are really multiple systems at play, and they often all tend to be failing Black communities.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the unemployment rate in communities of color, especially African-American communities, why it is consistently about twice as high as the general population and what can be done about it this hour. If you have an idea, have a question, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Connie Raza, for the purposes of your report, how do you define full employment? What would that look like?
Sure. So full employment would be essentially where there are about one job seeker for every job vacancy. And you could identify having achieved it by looking at wage growth. So if wages are growing at about the same rate that productivity is increasing, then we know that we're getting to a full employment economy. So productivity is the the income generated by work in the economy as a whole, and that's increased substantially over the past 35 years. Mm-hmm. But wages have not increased for anybody at nearly the rate of productivity. So when you start seeing those rates increasing at the same time, you know that workers are able to be sure that when they leave a job that's unsatisfying, that they're able to find another job, that there's not too much surplus labor, that there aren't many, many people looking for each job that's available, and workers are able to negotiate their fair value.
Matt?
Yeah, and this is exactly why school and educational opportunity is so important in our economy right now, is because it's an increasingly technical and competitive economy, and unfortunately, many of the school districts that African-American children are coming up through are some of the worst educations and opportunities available in our country.
And then when you add to that as you pointed out, the disciplinary rates are much higher for boys of color than that, that gets them off to a bad start right off the bat.
Right.
The other thing that I would just add to that is I think that in an economy like ours, where there are so many people vying for each job that's available, employers have really the luxury to inflate the requirements for their jobs. And so while many of the jobs in our economy are highly technical, do require more education, many don't, but are requiring it because that's a way of limiting the labor pool. And so, you know, by achieving full employment, part of what you do is you limit the room for employers to either have excess educational requirements, unnecessary requirements around criminal records, and to give in to, you know, their own bias in discriminating against African-American or Latino applicants.
You said in the report, Connie, that budget shortfalls during the recession led to significant contractions in public sector jobs, which are disproportionately held by blacks and women. And that was certainly true in Ohio. And they're saying in Ohio, they don't want to return those jobs they don't want to start those jobs up again. They want to keep them closed.
Right. I mean, this is one of the things that is going to have a long lasting impact, not just on employment, but on the quality of life for everybody in states and cities across the country who did see that kind of contraction during the recession. That meant that, again, disproportionately African-American workers and women workers were out of jobs, and if they found replacement jobs, were finding replacements that maybe didn't have the kind of wages or benefits that they were able to accrue. And certainly didn't have the kind of wage and compensation parity that you see in government employment. But it's not just a problem from the employment side. It's also a problem because it means that there are fewer people providing the public services that we all rely on.
Right, and that's that they're outsourcing a lot too, Matt Martin, to firms that are smaller firms that are not necessarily obligated by the same standards as public sector.
Yeah. There's a lot of research today that's showing how privatization is increasing everywhere, and so you know, there are some good reasons for that, to try and economize tax dollars and that sort of thing, but when it's increasingly all of the city services, then, yeah, there's a difference in how hiring happens in the sectors. We see that.
So, Connie Raza, I wanted to talk about your organization and its argument that federal monetary policy has exacerbated economic disparities in recent decades. The disparity has been relatively stable since the 1970s. Not that that's good, but it has been fairly stable. How has the Fed hurt the cause of black employment?
So racial disparities in employment have been fairly steady. Racial disparities in wages have actually been growing over the last 35 or so years. And over the last 35 or so years, the Federal Reserve has really prioritized its inflationary concerns. So the Federal Reserve is responsible for balancing considerations of the employment rate, how many people are employed, and what is what it calls the natural rate of unemployment, sort of the rate below which more people really can't be employed. Mm-hmm. And then it's also supposed to balance that with concerns about inflation. And, you know, before the recession, certainly the inflationary concerns have really been the driver for Federal Reserve decisions. During the recession, the Federal Reserve really did do what it could to return the economy to recovery. And what we're saying is that the Fed needs to continue to prioritize its responsibility to achieve full employment. We see no threat of runaway inflation at this time. And so raising interest rates right now in order to stave off this phantom threat of inflation really would just slow the economy. It would really challenge our ability to meet the full employment mandate and could really damage the ability of African Americans in particular, but all workers, to see the benefits of full employment economy.
You know, they've been bandying about the idea of the prime interest rate for a couple years now, talking about when's the right time, when's not the right time. I mean, they're always talking about it. It's always in play. How would they change the policy to give you a sense of security about what it would do?
Well, partly the Federal Reserve has been having very public disagreements among some of its governors around whether this is the time to begin to raise interest rates. And some of what I would call inflation hawks have been saying that now's the time to start raising interest rates in order to keep inflation low. And that's the reason that we're really looking at this as a decision point, because the Fed has said that it's really starting to consider raising the interest rates. The problem with raising the interest rates, though, is that there's no threat of runaway inflation, but there is a threat that the recovery that we've seen so far will stagnate. Wages have not made up for the losses that they've experienced over the last 15 years. They have not demonstrated strong growth. And so we know that we're not approaching a full employment economy. That's the reason that it's important that the Federal Reserve hold the course and not raise the interest rate.
You've also called for more diversity in the Federal Reserve and among its board of governors.
Yes.
Tell us about that. What are you shooting for there?
So the Federal Reserve is actually, it comprises 12 regional boards, and those boards of directors drive the decisions at the Federal Reserve in D.C. around interest rates and other monetary policy. Right now, two of the directors represent workers' organizations, but 87% of the seats in the regional boards are filled by bank and corporate leaders. Certainly, banks, the financial and commercial sectors, should have a seat at the table when talking about the economy. But so should people who experience the economy as workers and as consumers, and that's the way that the Federal Reserve was set up. Right now, the board of directors don't reflect the public that's actually affected by their decisions. So we're saying – oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say we're saying that the selection process for the presidents of those regional boards should be – more public than it is. Right now, it happens in something of a black box, and that the regional boards should more accurately reflect the community as a whole.
A lot of people think of the Federal Reserve as sort of, you know, more of a macroeconomic agency that looks at the really, really big picture and doesn't break it out into groups in terms of who it will benefit and who it will hurt. It's more, you don't see it that way?
No, it certainly is. I think that the problem is that, let me step back. It certainly does look at macroeconomic forces. And I think that what we're calling for is holding the course to make sure that we achieve true full employment. And that would include everybody, so that they do look at some of the breakdowns of where there is disproportionate unemployment, even though they're not, that's the driver of their decisions isn't going to be Black unemployment. If the driver of their decisions is wage growth, we know that they will achieve, get to full employment, and that will disproportionately benefit African-American workers.
Okay.
Because
go ahead.
It's historically, the difference between Black unemployment and white unemployment is historically about double, even without accounting for the other factors that keep that gap.
Mm-hmm.
Black unemployment, if the country's unemployment is at 7%, will be 14%. That's a 7-point difference. If the country's unemployment rate is at 4%, Black unemployment is 8%, which is 4% difference. Mm-hmm. It makes a disproportionate impact. So that's one piece of why I think that it's important that we're not saying that African Americans should be disproportionately considered by the Federal Reserve. They should still keep this macroeconomic lens, mm-hmm. and even doing that, they will benefit African American communities as they'll benefit the whole country by actually achieving full employment.
Connie Raza, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
It's Connie Raza. She is the Director of Strategic Research and Economic Justice for the Center for Popular Democracy. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. At any point in the past 50 years, African and Black Americans have fared twice as badly as the general public when it comes to rates of unemployment. Even the recovery from the Great Recession of 2008, resolved 6 years later with Black unemployment roughly twice that of the overall numbers, that is 9.9% compared to 5.2%. We're talking about why and what can be done to change that paradigm. Still with us is Matt Martin of the Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity at Ohio State University. Joining us now is Suzanne Coleman-Tolbert. She's president and CEO of the Central Ohio Workforce Investment Corporation. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Through your public-private partnerships, you connect job seekers and businesses with training, resources, and employment services needed to support economic development in Central Ohio. What have you learned from those partnerships about why African Americans continue to trail in unemployment rolls?
Well, as we have been talking earlier, I think it's multifaceted. First of all, I just want to say thank you for having me on and to talk about the number of people that we see come through the job centers, approximately 10,000 to 12,000, depending on how well the economy is doing. And of course, the economy is doing well now. We have an opportunity to work with probably about 400 employers, small, medium, large employers, and have an opportunity to talk to them about their workforce needs and to kind of gauge what they're looking for in terms of skill sets, personalities, whether or not someone's going to be fitting in. Now, our demographics show that African Americans disproportionately represent the number of people that we see in the job center. We serve about 53% of our population that represents African Americans. To me, that's high, especially looking at the fact that our population is 24%.
Mm-hmm.
So why are they still unemployed? I think there are many challenges that African Americans are still experiencing. We all know the biases that still exist with employers. That has not gone away. It certainly is an employer's market. And so with everything equal, if you look at it, two individuals, let's say two African-American males, and all aspects of them seemingly are equal, including their socioeconomic background, family size, education, we are still seeing that the African-American male does not land that job, may get the interview, but doesn't get called back for the job.
Do you talk to employers about why that is?
We don't come right out and say, why didn't you hire that African-American male? What we do is to focus more on the job seeker and their experience in the interview. And what we're finding is that they're not as engaged as we're hearing from our other job seekers. Who
Engaged
in the interview.
Okay.
In other words, if they do get called in for an interview, the questions are very mundane. If there are 10 questions, they go through the 10 questions, and then it's a thank you very much, we'll be in touch.
So when you say they aren't as engaged in the interview, the employers are not as engaged in the interview.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's the feedback that we're getting back from the job seeker, whereas with some of our other job seekers, they really get engaged in the interview. The employer may want to find out a little more about their experiences educationally, what kinds of things they like, whether or not they like to work with teams or they do better on their own. Mm-hmm. Those are some of the questions that oftentimes don't get asked of African Americans. And again, we are making quite a few assumptions that they're just not interested in hiring that person. Now, that's with some employers. We are finding that there's a change. There seems to be an increase in our employers who want to, quote unquote, take a chance with individuals who they feel may not be the best fit, but they're going to give them a chance anyway.
And why are they doing that? Why are they willing to take risks now? Is there some other outside force?
I think because there's a greater need now for individuals who really want to work. There's a need for the workforce to be increased. There are lots of jobs. We know that, especially in Central Ohio. We're very fortunate to have companies who have opened up their doors and have even put in place opportunities for people to be trained. So it's not so much even looking at whether or not you're skilled. That is an important factor, and I want to get to that. But we're having employers say, look, send me 20 people who want to get up in the morning, who want to show up on time, and we will train them how to do the job. And so I think they're looking past the biases that they may have had in the past and giving people that chance. We're also seeing an increase in employers who are taking a chance with individuals who may have background issues.
Criminal records,
mm-hmm. Even individuals who may have nonviolent felonies. Mm-hmm. They're finding out that these individuals who have gone through some type of community-based reentry program are more motivated. They obviously have more at stake. They want to reestablish themselves in the community. And through a program that we have that Mayor Coleman started called the Restoration Academy, where we have lots of community partners coming together and saying, look, we're going to make sure that individuals have what they need and kind of take away those barriers and excuses for this not to work, either for the employer or mm-hmm. for the job seeker. That program over the past 3 years has been extremely successful with an 83% retention rate on full-time employment. So, but it takes a lot of sitting down with individuals and taking them through what employers call essential skills, soft mm-hmm. skills, making sure that they understand what the workplace looks like today.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the unemployment rate for African Americans in Ohio, especially, which echoes the national rate. It's roughly double that of the general population and even much higher than that than the majority white population. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. With me in the studio, Matt Martin of the Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity at OSU, and also Suzanne Coleman-Tolbert. She's the president and CEO of the Central Ohio Workforce Investment Corporation. Alex in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Alex.
Hi. I will be concise.
Hey, Alex, could I interrupt you? Could you pull the phone a little way from your mouth, please?
Oh, you know what? Let me take it off of speaker for one.
That's good.
All right, here we go.
That's good.
All right. You know, this really, I'm going to be concise. This isn't really a complex issue in my mind, because it's just a difficult one to confront and address. When you consider who determines who gets hired, who gets fired, who's promoted, who's given 70% of the dollar, since the inception of America, white men are the enforced quota and template of every position, every industry, every corporation, every job, including jobs as cops, construction workers, education, whatever. They are the de facto reserve. They are de facto reserve for whites. There's no industry that they don't dominate. Now, until we get rid of reserving a group that has displayed a certain pattern of discrimination, the root of the problem, women will not get their due, and all others but white men will always suffer from this unspoken rigged situation, because every white male is not qualified for every job. And this is not against every white person and every white male, but if you look at the pattern, that's where the root of the problem is.
You know, thank you, Alex. Thanks for that call. It's true. White males dominate every business in the country, all things being equal. And the issue of implicit bias has been raised. Now, it cuts both ways. It's not just that the proverbial white male doesn't want to hire somebody, but the proverbial white male, just like anybody, feels more comfortable hiring someone who looks like them. Right, Matt Martin?
Yeah, that's right. Actually, there's implicit bias research that shows where tests have been done, where you take the same resume and you put a traditionally white sounding name on the top of it, and you put a traditionally African American sounding name on it. There's a difference in how many callbacks they get. And tests have actually shown that. So it's not just an inclination that's out there. That's actually true.
And then that follows through into that interview process, Suzanne.
It does. And back to the resume, you know, I think for African Americans, like anyone else, we're very proud of our experiences and associations that we have. And I know that there has also been research done where if we identify an organization, let's just say the Black Association of Pipe Fitters, that's a dead giveaway, you know, that I'm African-American. And but yet for any other race, that's not taken into consideration. So there are things that we have to point out to individuals while they're doing resumes, not necessarily discouraging them from identifying their experiences. But we point out what the triggers are for filtering out individuals in interviews.
It's so unfortunate, though, because so many of those organizations are ones that have helped them develop and ones that they're active
they
in.
They are.
And it point to their...
And one of the ways that we coach individuals is to talk about the skill sets, the leadership skills, their ability to facilitate meetings or join teams because of their association with a particular group. So not to necessarily discount who they are.
But make it more three-dimensional.
Exactly.
According to the Bureau of Justice Statistics, and this is something we brought up a little bit earlier and I wanted to get into a little bit deeper, people of color make up about 30% of the U.S. population but account for 60% of those in our jails and prisons. The prison population grew by 700% from 1970 to 2005. Roughly following the Civil Rights Act and to about 10 years ago, one in every 15 African-American men and one in every 36 Hispanic men are incarcerated. And that's compared to one in every 106 white men. Now, the statistic was mentioned earlier, one out of three black males will expect to be incarcerated or in jailed or arrested or something like that. That's a higher rate, but that's just to be arrested. We're talking about people who are actually put in prison. To what extent really does the disproportionate incarceration of blacks in Ohio play a role in the disparity that we know of? Because that's profound.
It's just stunning to me when I see the statistics that we collect in the center and how many individuals, and this is self-disclosure, so the numbers are probably higher than what we know about or hear about and collect information on. But I'm stunned at how many individuals have had experiences being incarcerated and how long that they have been out of work because of their records. And then we wonder why people can't connect up with the community and the world of work.
Right. I mean, I know there's lots of factors, but Matt Martin, that's got to be a huge one.
Yeah.
Those things follow them the rest of their lives.
It has a profound effect on who's in the labor force and the size of the labor force. And there's plenty of research that shows that the unemployment rate, when you actually do account for all the folks who are not in the labor force because of a felony, either because they're currently incarcerated or because they've been released and they've been looking so long that they're no longer in the labor force, that the black unemployment rate is actually much higher than what statistics show.
And it's somewhat encouraging that a lot of people, former prison inmates, are turning to entrepreneurial jobs and trying to start their own businesses, because maybe another problem is, you mentioned earlier, access to jobs, but keeping jobs in a neighborhood is another issue, right, Suzanne?
Keeping jobs in the neighborhood, but also encouraging individuals to go back and to continue their education, because from our vantage point, education is the ticket to good employment and getting on a good career pathway. And many of these individuals have not had the opportunity to either continue their high school diploma, get a GED, or if they were fortunate enough to start some college, it was interrupted. And so one of the things that we know is extremely important that you put two individuals side by side. If I have an associate's degree and someone else has a master's degree and everything else is equal, I'm not going to get that job.
And Alex made the point earlier about who controls most of the jobs in the country. The Central Ohio Workforce Investment Corporation works to get people jobs. Does it work, or is there a place or a role for it at all beyond that to help people move up the food chain?
Yes. I mean, and we work very closely, like I said, with employers to make sure that when individuals do get what we call that survival job, that it may be a survival job that could lead to an entry-level job at minimum wage, $8.10. But in 60 or 90 days, with a little more training and experience, they can move up and get increases in their wages. It's all about the dollar that I'm able to bring home so that I can buy the basic needs that all the rest of us are enjoying, putting food on the table, having reliable transportation. If I have children, being able to pay for childcare. I mean, anyone who has young children, they understand how difficult it is to come up with those dollars. That's one of the struggles that we're having with individuals who are receiving public assistance and have support to have child care. Without that child care, I'm not able to continue my education or get a job. But once I reach a certain wage, then I meet what's called the benefit cliff. And I fall off that cliff and I'm no longer eligible to receive those desperately needed benefits of
the
supporting
stamps,
my family.
The
food assistance,
subsidies for child care,
transportation. Mm-hmm. And it's not that I want to continue doing this forever, but it's a choice that I have to make, and I have to make it relatively soon once my employer says, you're up for a raise.
Well, Suzanne Coleman-Tolbert, thank you for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
That's Suzanne Coleman-Tolbert. She is president and CEO of the Central Ohio Workforce Investment Corporation. We'll continue our conversation about the African-American unemployment rate, why it is double the general rate in Ohio and across the nation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the unemployment rate for African Americans in Ohio and across the country. Black unemployment is higher than Hispanic unemployment, which is higher than white unemployment, not just this year, but for the last four decades and beyond. One description of the numbers suggests a workforce stratified, if not calcified, by race, with whites seeking higher wages and lower unemployment than their black and Hispanic counterparts. Still with us is Matt Martin of the Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity at Ohio State University. Joining us now by phone is sociologist Donald Tomaszkiewicz, DV, co-author of Documenting Desegregation, Racial and Gender Segregation in Private Sector Employment Since the Civil Rights Act. Welcome to the show.
It's my pleasure to be here.
You wrote that after the Civil Rights Act, one might say that the game was no longer fixed to ensure white male dominance, but that it would be naive to say that the rules were suddenly made fair. What happened? Did they just simply not address kind of the fine points, the details?
Well, it could be, if you take a long historical view on it, the kind of the nature of racial inequality has changed. And back on the Civil Rights Act, was passed, we essentially had an apartheid society. White male advantages in all walks of life, but especially in employment, were uncontested and even most of the time taken for granted, even if resented. What happened over time is we had an increase of opportunity in employment, but life also became more subtle, and at the end of your last conversation, you were talking about kind of the issues of how do you get into good jobs as opposed to into jobs, and a lot of what happened after the Civil Rights Act had to do with, okay, what are the practices that employers could switch to that would help move in that direction, and there you're absolutely right. Nobody had a clue.
You wrote that in 1964, it looked as if the civil rights movement had won equal employment opportunity only for black men. But just a few decades later, it would appear that its primary beneficiaries were white women, but also white women who were earning less than their white male counterparts, getting less, less management type positions and that sort of thing.
Yeah, though, that's right. And so the early pressure, political pressure, obviously came from the civil rights movement. There was no women's movement that had much political power until the early 70s. Mm-hmm. And the mere fact of changing the laws does not produce sufficient pressure on employers to change their behavior. Thus, race progress happened faster.
On paper.
Well, there was also real progress in the 60s and early 70s compared to where we'd been beforehand. Mm-hmm. There's been almost no racial progress since 1980, and that has a lot to do with the evaporation of political pressure on employers.
Where would the political pressure go?
Well, in terms of the civil rights movement, by the late 60s, most of the leadership had been assassinated or imprisoned. By 1980, there had been a fairly vigorous reverse politics around race coming out of the Republican Party. And so by the time Ronald Reagan was elected, employers were pretty clear that they were not going to have a lot of pressure from the federal government for further progress on the racial front for African Americans. Of course, Hispanics at the time weren't even on the radar.
Right.
But the women's movement continued to have influence on employers and on government through the 90s. And so you continue to see progress there.
Matt Martin, just in terms of the competition for jobs, is that a dynamic there, that there is a period of time where African-American males particularly are competing with white women for jobs that used to be closed to both of them?
Well, yeah, I suppose that's part of it. But I think, you know, another thing that he's speaking to is the challenge that we faced as a nation after the 1964 Civil Rights Act was that we were a segregated society. And so where jobs were going and where jobs were growing were in different places than where black men and women lived. Mm-hmm. And so there started to be, you know, after the 1960s and 70s, a real physical gap that grew between people and where jobs and opportunities actually were. And so to your question, I think, you know, white women were more likely to be in a position to take advantage of some of those new opportunities than black men or women.
Just by dint of physical...
Right, where the jobs were and where neighborhoods were still segregated.
Don, you mentioned that, you know, you break down the trajectories away from the predominantly white male privilege scenario before the 1964 Civil Rights Act, and you break them down into historical eras, and you identified the period between 1960 and 1972 as particularly important to the advancement of African Americans in the workplace. And you're saying that that had primarily to do with just sort of the leadership in the movement, and then it sort of went away, and people were left dangling. They didn't have a guiding force.
Well, in the 60s, yes, it seems to be that it was political pressure. If you think about it from an employer's point of view, there's new legislation. There's a civil rights movement. The EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, is formed. Federal contractors are beginning to be have oversight. Now, all of that pressure, both the regulatory pressure and the political pressure, is about the status of African Americans in American society. And so employers reacted to that pressure, and they did it fairly quickly. They did it even before they had invented diversity policies and various human resource policies that might allow them to do it. The world looked a lot more chaotic and uncertain than it does today.
Well, you know, I wanted to talk about something you mentioned in the paper as well. You said it makes more sense to look for local inequality regimes.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me a little bit more about what you mean by that.
I think that, you know, we've been talking mostly about the historical issues, but the contemporary issues are that we're no longer in an apartheid society. But that doesn't mean we know that race doesn't matter in the interactions between employees and their employers, or gender for that matter. And the real questions we need to be asking now is which employers show more reluctance to hire or promote African Americans. There's even a pattern of resegregation in some industries that suggests that once the political pressure let up, some industries went back to old patterns of putting of sorting blacks and whites into different jobs within the firm. So
can you give me an example of that?
Well, it's most striking among federal contractors. Huh. So in the manufacturing industries that were the most responsive to the civil rights movement in the 60s and 70s and were supervised by the federal government because of threats of where affirmative action was a mandated policy, it's in those industries that we see a reversal of progress for African Americans.
I was in preparing for this and thinking about this show. I was more alert, maybe to what was going on in kind of ancillary discussions regarding same-sex marriage.
Yeah.
And the acceptance of gays and all, and the push by industry to get same-sex marriage legalized in the United States. Companies that were, you know, flying the flag all over the place.
Right.
I thought about that in terms of the African American plight in unemployment in this country and where the flags are for them.
Yeah. No, I think that's really the a very apt and important comparison. It's one that I'm paying a lot of attention to myself as well. Here, what we have again is a vibrant social movement, very strategically targeting marriage equality, something that's not very threatening, either to employers or to coworkers, and strategically moving sometimes to the state legislature, sometimes to state courts, sometimes now to the Supreme Court, and getting really dramatic expansions of civil rights and dignity. And of course, then for the LGBT movement, the next step is going to be to think about employment. So I think there's real parallels to the African-American case. The interesting question is, okay, how would we get a similar right. kind of concern for African-Americans today as the LGBT movement has generated for their has generated? And that's a harder nut to crack. And I think we see some of it in the Black Lives Matters politics, mm-hmm. which has been mostly focused on the police. But it goes
to the whole idea of humanizing individuals.
Exactly. That was the next sentence I was going to say. No, it's quite all right. I think it is. It's about sort of saying, everybody, all of these people are human beings, should be treated with dignity. Well, maybe that means should be allowed to marry or treated with dignity at work. I think that the long march of history is about that kind of encompassing notion of our shared humanity. We do tend to advance it by kind of identity group politics, one group at a time, however.
Mm-hmm. Matt Martin, any sense in your research about a strategy from that point of view?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things we're speaking to here is just the nature of kind of the layers of discrimination and the historic legacy of discrimination of various kinds. And so I think the gap or the differences that you see in movements has to do a lot with that. But, you know, going back to something we talked about a little bit earlier, one good thing that's happening is that some businesses are starting to take a triple bottom line approach. And so they're thinking about both social implications, economic implications, profit, and the environment. And so locally here we look at like a Clean Turn or Joe DeLoss and his work with Fresh Box and Hot Chicken. Is there's this intentional effort to hire hard-to-employ mm-hmm. folks and to train them and to get them back into the rest of the workforce. And so I think there are some promising signs like that we can look to.
So there's a moral imperative, Don Tomaszkiewicz?
Well, I think, most of us as human beings live moral lives when we are face-to-face with people who we recognize as other human beings. Mm. The imperative, I think, is to broaden and deepen that recognition of each of our shared humanity. I think that the triple bottom line idea is a very good one. And it says that what we should take into account is more than just profits at the corporate level. One of the things that we see for best practices in terms of the advancement of African Americans in workplaces is it's much more likely to happen when this becomes part of normal business practice. If you kind of layer diversity as a distraction from normal business practice into managers' everyday life, they tend to resist or ignore it.
Donald Tomaszkiewicz, DV, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure.
Donald Tomaszkiewicz, DV, he's a professor of sociology at University of Massachusetts Amherst, co-author of the book Documenting Desegregation, Racial and Gender Segregation in Private Sector Employment Since the Civil Rights Act. Also, Matt Martin, thanks to you.
Thank you.
Matt Martin, he's senior researcher at the Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity at Ohio State University. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, All Sides interns Shahina Sagiri, Ryan McFadden, Sam Buck, and Matt Berkeley, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.